Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a very exciting show for you today. My guest is going to be Robert Brinkman. Dr. Robert Brinkman is a professor and the director of sustainability studies at Hofstra University. And I'm very excited to have him joining me on the show, and I'll tell you more about what he does in a little bit. But first, I want to just talk to you about what's going on in and around the city and share a recipe with you and make suggestions on ways you can get involved in making our world a better place. So coming up in the city, this weekend is a big weekend. On Governor's Island, from 2 to 10 on September 6th, there is a huge party planned. It's called Governor's Island Music and Seafood Beach Party. There's going to be lots of live music, great seafood, craft beer, and it's a happening. So it's at Governor's Island Beach Club. You can go to, I believe if you just Google Governor's Island Beach Club, you'll find out more information. But some of the headliners include Bad Fish and Bob Marley's tribute band and Jimmy Buffett. Band, tribute band, and some really great music. So hope to see you there. September 7th is a food fest of Brooklyn's Best. That's the East River State Park on September 7th from 1 to 5. And if you go to Edible Brooklyn, I'm sure you'll find out more about that. September 7th also is the North Fork Foodie Tour. I've been talking to you about that for a while. That's always a wonderful event. And some of the best chefs from the North Fork will be there. Great sustainable wine from some of the East End's wineries. So come out for that. Also, September 7th is the continuation of the Tin House Music at Restoration Farm. This weekend, Kerry Kearney will be playing there. They start at 2 o'clock with an open mic, and then at 3 o'clock, Kerry will come on. So hope you can join Restoration Farm. That's in Old Bethpage, adjacent to Old Bethpage Village, but you enter actually from Sweet Hollow Road. So come out for that. September 9th is Climate Change, Food, and Health at the CUNY Graduate Center, and that's From Analysis to Action to Protect Our Futures. And that should be a really great happening. And they have a whole lineup of events that will be taking place at the CUNY Graduate Center for health and wellness. So check that out. September 17th is Just Foods Let Us Eat Local event. Every year they have this at the Altman Building on 135 West 18th Street from 6:30 to 10. I actually think 6:30 to 7:30 is a VIP ticket, and then 7:30 to 10 is the regular ticket. You know, the prices for the tickets are a little steep, but it is a great cause, and if you can swing it, it's a fun place to go to. You'll meet lots of great people, have delicious tastes of food from some of the best, most sustainable local eateries in the city. I want to encourage you all to save the date, and I'll talk more about this in a little while. The People's Climate March is coming up September 21st, and this is being planned by many, many nonprofit organizations. I think there's over 850 sponsoring organizations. This is planned to be the largest climate march in history in our own city, New York City. It is to coincide with the United Nations Climate Summit that is taking place starting on Monday, the 23rd. And so, I think that's Tuesday, the 23rd. Anyway, this People's Climate March is being pegged to be a huge, huge event. And the way they are breaking it up, instead of being able to get one large stage with lots of speakers and musicians, they've broken it up into many different contingents, and I will be taking part in the food justice contingency, which will be meeting off of Columbus Circle on one of the side streets, and as soon as I know which side street we get assigned to, I will share that with all of you. But the food justice contingency will be marching with Brooklyn Food Coalition, the Long Island Food Coalition, Slow Food, Huntington, IE Green, loads of the Sierra Club, loads of other organizations that are really wanting to bring attention to how climate change is affecting our food system, and how our food system and the poor food system really impacts those that are living on the fringe and are more in need. It affects all of us, but if you have money, you seem to be able to eat your way around it. those that don't really depend on, need to find the least expensive food that they can, this climate change is really going to affect them the worst. So come to the Food Justice Contingency. Stay tuned for more detailed information about that. But the People's Climate March, you can Google it. You can, it's listed on every nonprofit organization in the New York area is talking about it. So it's going to be really great. Please come. There's also an event that evening, a farm-to-table dinner at Restoration Farm. That doesn't start till 5 o'clock, so you can first come to the climate change and then share a beautiful farm-to-table dinner at Restoration Farm. And you can find out more information about that on their website. September 23rd is a socially responsible investing dinner where I will be cooking the farm-to-table dinner part of the event. And some specialists from Morgan Stanley will be talking about how to invest with an impact, how to take your money out of the corporations that are investing in fossil fuels and biotech like Monsanto, and then take that money and invest it in green companies, companies that are doing the right thing in addition to local farms and agriculture and things like that. So you want to invest your money with an impact. Come to this socially responsible investing dinner. If you want more information, you can send me an email at bhavani@iegreen.com. They'd be happy to tell you more about it. I'm happy to say that we finally have a date for Slow Food North Shore's next Food on Film series. We will be showing The Sturgeon Queen, which is a great film, a documentary film about Russ and Daughters down on the Lower East Side. And that will be October 14th at 7:30 at the Cinema Arts Center, followed by a Q&A and reception with lots of that delicious Russ and Daughter type food. So I hope many of you can join us for that. So I just want to go back to this climate march and talk to you all about why it's so important that we all come together and let our elected officials know how important it is to us. Because we've been talking about climate change for a long time, and our officials, including President Obama, has said how they are going to make that a priority and be known as a president that really made a change, Governor Cuomo as well. And yet, they keep doing things that are not really in alignment with promoting sustainable agriculture and promoting alternative energies like wind and solar. And we need to really hold them accountable. And the only way we can do that, I remember President Obama saying, make me do it. And what he meant by that is, create such a strong alliance of people on the ground that he can go and say, to Congress, look, this is what the people want. This is who you represent. We need to hear them and not just answer to the corporations that are handing out the big bucks. And it's really, really hard to do that. And, one of the things we have to do is try to turn around that law that allows corporations to vote with money like people. And so we need to turn that around. A couple of things that are in the news that I want to share with you. There is a new app that will tell you whether or not some of your favorite foods are donating to Republican agenda or Democratic agenda. And I thought that would be really interesting. And to find out more information, it's called the Bipartisan app, B-U-Y Partisan. And really interesting to find out who's donating to what. For instance, General Mills Honey Nut Cheerios made 63.5% of its donations to Republicans and 24% to Democrats. It's just interesting information. If you have extra time and you want to find out about that, check it out. Also, there was an interesting article that said that our brains can actually be trained to prefer healthy foods from junk foods, but it takes time, and it also involves being watching what you eat and keeping yourself satiated at all times. Don't allow yourself to get hungry, because when you get hungry, that's when those cravings for the unhealthy foods really take hold of your brain and make you want to do the wrong thing. On my website, there's also requests for you to sign some petitions. One is to ask organic producers who are part of the International Dairy Foods Association to please withdraw their membership from the International Dairy Foods Association, because they are giving so much money and lobbying to turn around the GMO labeling laws that have been passed in Vermont and Washington State and Colorado. And so we have a right to know, and this GMO labeling issue has become so ridiculous at this point. I mean, it's like, what is the big deal? How come they can't just label it and let us know what's in our foods? I mean, I would love to see GMOs being outlawed, but that's not even what we're trying to do here. We're just trying to ask permission to be told when foods that we're eating have GMOs in it, and that's what they don't want us to do. And the reason they don't want it is because they're afraid. They're afraid that once you label products and say that it contains GMO ingredients, then people won't want to buy it. And that's true. So what it will do is, instead of companies succumbing to labeling, they're going to reformulate their products and try to make their products without GMOs, which will be better for all of us. That's what they do in Europe. Everything that they make in this country that is also sold in Europe for the European market is GMO-free, but for our market, it is not. And that's because, as Americans, we want cheap food, and that's what they're giving us, is cheap food. And we deserve better, and we need to let them know we do not want the cheaper food. We want the cleaner food. So please go onto my website and sign that petition. There's also a petition to let Governor Cuomo know that we want him to invest in clean energy here on Long Island. Long Island, we have been the recipients of some of the highest electrical bills in the country, way back with Lilco, with Shoreham Nuclear Power Plant. When they decided to close that down, we had to pay for all the mistakes that they made. Our electrical bills have been through the roof. And now there's an opportunity to make some investments in a wind farm off of Jones Beach and into the Long Island, into the ocean out there, and also to really invest in solar energy. And we really want to let Governor Cuomo know that, you know, he mentioned that he would do that, and we want to hold him accountable to that. So please sign the petition on my website about that. Also, there's a wonderful woman I just met, new to Long Island, and she is here through an organization called Green Corps. And Green Corps is a nonprofit organization that places people in strategic areas that need to work on different issues. And they have put Hillary Hunt with New Yorkers Against Fracking. She's here on Long Island, and she is really going to be working very hard to raise the awareness about the fracking issue and to try to get Long Islanders to understand why it's important for us, as well as everywhere across the country, to stand up against fracking. Especially out in California, it just baffles me when they are dealing with so much drought, how they can allow millions of gallons per well to be, to be injected into the ground, you know, miles deep into the earth, near fault lines, causing earthquakes and creating contaminated water. And our farmers, who grow the majority of the produce that we eat year-round when we can't grow in season here in New York and other parts of the country, they don't have water to water their fields. I mean, it's ridiculous. We have alternative energies. We have other resources. We do not need to be doing this fracking. And, the connections, when I talk about how everything is interconnected, if you follow the connections of fracking and you not only use a non-renewable resource such as clean water, and then you have to deal with the waste of that clean water and all the other chemicals. It's just a stupid, stupid idea. And so we need to all get involved. There will be lots of petitions coming around. You'll see them in your emails. Please sign them and let our officials know that we do not want fracking. And please, there will be an event coming up on Long Island. I will share that with you next week. I don't have all the details yet, but it will be taking place at Cold Spring Harbor Library. But I know in the city as well, there's all these different ways of getting involved. In New York is against fracking and Food and Water Watch, and I really beg all of you to take that up. So now, before I invite my guest on, I want to share with you a recipe, and I have to tell you, I'm so happy that I made this peach torte last week, and next week I'm going to share with you the vegan alternative recipe. But I went out to my tree this morning to getting ready to pick my peaches, and every single one is gone. I am completely upset. I've been picking the ones that have been dropping off the tree and using them and cutting any bruised areas out and waiting for them to be perfectly ripe. And they were perfectly ripe. And now some animal just took them, every single last one. So I have no more peaches. So hopefully you can find some delicious peaches. You know, there's nothing like organic peaches that you can pick right off the tree. They are dripping wet with delicious juice, and it's just amazing compared to the peaches you buy in a store. So anyway, for the peach tart, you need a 3/4 cup of organic sugar, 1/2 cup of unsalted butter, 1 cup of organic unbleached flour, 1 teaspoon baking soda, pinch of salt, 2 organic eggs, 1 teaspoon vanilla, 10 small peaches that you blanch, you pit, and you slice and peel, brown sugar, lemon juice, and cinnamon. So I start by bringing a large pot of water to a boil. Then I add the peaches and let it boil for about 3 minutes. And then I remove them from the boiling water and transfer them into an ice bath. And what this does is it shocks them. It stops any more of the cooking, but it causes the skin to just peel right off. So then you just peel the skin right off, and then I slice them and put them into a bowl. In an electric mixer, I cream the sugar and the butter together until fluffy. Then I add the eggs one at a time, add in the vanilla. In a separate bowl, I combine the flour, the baking soda, and the salt. And then I add the dry mixture to the butter mixture, beat it well. And then I put that into a tart pan and spread the batter all around. And then I lay all the peaches out on top of the tort pan. And there's actually so many peaches, and I just lightly press the peaches down into the batter. And you bake it for almost an hour, 55 minutes or so. You can keep a watch on it. I bake it at a 350-degree oven. Keep a watch on it. If it starts to get too dark on the top, you can put some tin foil on top. And you know it's ready when a toothpick inserted into it comes out clean. And you just remove it from the oven. Let it cool a little bit before you remove the tray from the tart pan. I use a tart pan where the bottom releases from the sides, and the sides are all fluted edge. So when you remove it, it looks really beautiful. And if you'd like, you can serve it with a cream, or you can sprinkle a little powdered sugar on top for garnish, and it looks really pretty. So let me know how it is. As I said, next week I will be sharing with you the vegan recipe of this recipe and showing you how you can substitute, some whole wheat pastry flour, some coconut oil, and do away with the eggs and the butter. So I will share that with you next week. And now it's my pleasure to invite on Dr. Robert Brinkman, also known as Bob. He is the professor at Hofstra University and the director for the Sustainability Studies at Hofstra University. He's also the director of the Sustainability Research and National Center for Suburban Studies. He holds a geology BS and MS and a PhD in geography. And his research is largely focused on urban and suburban environmental sustainability. He's published, you know, many articles, and he's done a couple books, and he has a new book coming out that I'll let him tell us about. And Bob, are you with us?
I sure am. Thanks for having me today, Bhavani. Great to talk to you.
Oh, it's great to have you on. Thanks so much, and thank you so much for what you're doing and influencing so many young people, and their minds are so open, and you're filling them with all good stuff. So I thank you for that.
Thanks for trying. You know, it's the first week of classes here at Hofstra, and we just had a whole bunch of new students declare majors this week. So it's good news for everybody here.
Good. And is that department expanding?
We really are growing. You know, we started just a few years ago. I used to be at the University of South Florida for about 23 years, and I helped build a big environmental science and policy department there, and then came up here to Hofstra to try to do the same thing. And so far, we keep growing by leaps and bounds every year.
Oh, that's great. So good to hear. So you have a background in geology and worked in mineral exploration as a mineralogist. How did you transfer over with your interest into sustainability?
Well, what happened to me when I was out in the field, this is when I was working on my master's, getting ready to go into my PhD, I was purely a mining geologist, purely a mineralogist, looking, doing exploration for rare minerals. And I just had trouble trying to find natural places to get samples. We were sent out across the Midwest at that particular time, trying to find natural pieces of land where the ground wasn't disturbed. And as a geologist, I started to recognize that there was disturbance everywhere, from agriculture, from industry, from development of homes, and you couldn't find a natural sediment deposit in very many places. And people weren't really writing about that in geology at the time. This was in the mid to late 80s. And I started to realize, wait a second, I need to reframe my career on this, because this is a huge story that no one's telling about this massive change on the planet. And that's what got me to embrace this idea of sustainability and trying to understand the Earth system processes that are taking place and how they're transforming our planet in a very big way over a very short time period.
Yeah. You know, I'm not a scientist, but as someone who loves nature and loves the water, I can share that I remember when I was younger and went down to the Caribbean and went snorkeling. That first time I ever went snorkeling, what an unbelievable experience it was for me. The colors and the fish, and, you know, it was just amazing. And then I remember going back, you know, 10 years later, and it being so different. So
yeah.
Different in those 10 years. And I was shocked.
It's amazing.
You know,
right?
And I didn't have the scientific knowledge to know what was really happening, but I just started talking about it. And it was just, you know, and I think it was a similar thing of what you experienced. I mean, you just see the changes, and, you know, you don't know how to put your finger on it, but you know something's going on.
Yeah, and, you know, and since that time, since I started to do this work, scientists have been really measuring every corner of the Earth and finding very rapid change, whether it's through ecosystem change, biochemical changes, atmospheric chemistry changes, soil changes, even changes in the chemistry of recent ice forming in the Arctic and Antarctic. There's change everywhere, and it's a little bit concerning, well, big time concerning for many of us who understand what the implications of this might be.
Uh-huh. And, you know, the word sustainability these days is thrown around so much, and so many people use it just as a, you know, a lingo word to attract business almost. Can you define what sustainability means to you, and, you know, what it really means?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that the root of the understanding of sustainability came out in the 1980s when the United Nations published a report called Our Common Future. It's sometimes called the Brundtland Report, and that document defines sustainability as within the context of sustainable development. And that definition said sustainable development is development that meets the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their needs. Now, that definition is good, but it's a little bit vague. And since that definition, people have been trying to urge that we start measuring what it is that we're doing so that we can really quantify the impacts that we're having on future generations. So if you look at issues like the Green Revolution with the advent of fertilizers, for example, if we continue to use fertilizers at the rate that we're using, we'll see that in the not-too-distant future, greater problems with eutrophication, nitrogen and phosphorus pollution, greater problems in places where there's phosphorus mining, the chemicals involved with removing phosphorus from minerals in the ground are really quite damaging to the environment. And so if you start following these things through, you can predict what would happen if we continue on particular paths. And so that's what we're trying to teach people in our sustainability studies program, is it's not just about feeling good. We all are tree huggers, right? If you come into sustainability, you already are an environmentalist. But what we're trying to do with our students is to have them recognize that there are ways to quantify these things in ways that we can develop policy and urge organizations to have lighter footprints, whether it's related to fertilizers, related to energy, related to food production. How can we do these things better to try to reduce those long-term impacts?
Mm-hmm. You know, and yet it seems like our government is at such a disconnect when they know that we need to be looking at sustainability and the future and what actions we do today, how they will affect generations to come. And yet right now they're looking at, the Department of Agriculture is looking at approving Dow Chemical's new strain of GMO crops. Is that possible? I mean, I just, you know, and I was talking about fracking earlier. I don't know if you heard it. It's like, how is it possible that on one hand they participate in these climate summits and they talk about what's going on the planet and how we need to turn things around, and then, you know, the minute business, you know, gives them some money under the table, they're willing to sell our souls. I don't get it.
Yeah, there's a lot of cognitive dissonance out there right now with sustainability, and it is a little bit tough. I think back to 2009 when the Waxman-Markey bill was put forward, which was the big green energy bill that would have gotten us into cap and trade for carbon in this country. And we've been using cap and trade for decades here to reduce air pollution, especially related to try to reduce the impacts of acid rain. But at the time, all of a sudden, people were saying cap and trade is the worst thing. It's, you know, anti-capitalist and all the rest. And nothing could have been further from the truth. And today, or just last week, China announced that they're instituting a cap and trade program across China to try to reduce greenhouse gas pollution in China. And so the question really becomes, what is it that the U.S. will do on this? I mean, we have these presidential executive orders, but they can come and go depending on the presidency. So there's nothing really codified in U.S. law beyond what has been interpreted by the Supreme Court related to the Clean Air Act or Clean Water Act with climate change. So it's a frustrating time, no doubt.
Yeah, very frustrating. Now, you grew up in rural Wisconsin. How did that experience, and how rural was it? When you say rural, I don't really know. But how did that experience influence and shape the way you think about the environment and food today?
Well, I grew up in a really small town in Waterford, Wisconsin, and in between Milwaukee and Chicago. And our family had a cabin and a farm in northern Wisconsin, and we would spend many weekends and most of the summers up there. In our small town, we had a huge garden, but we also hunted and fished. We gathered a lot of food that was just growing wild on our farm or in other areas. And so this idea of sustainability was really infused in how I grew up. We built our own house in northern Wisconsin. We lived pretty simply compared to how most people live today. And it was a good lesson on how to really think about the modern world. Because if you look at how much we've changed in the course of 40 or 50 years, my life is much more complex, and I would say the lives of most Americans are much more complex. And we have a much larger footprint on the landscape than we did back in those early days. So a lot of my thinking was really infused by that much simpler time, and actually a much better time for kids to grow up, at least in my environment, for learning about these types of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know, the invention of computers and all this technology is supposed to make our lives easier, but I don't think it has.
Yeah, I remember, it's so funny thinking back in those days. I remember very young reading The Hobbit, and reading that book, it felt like where I lived in northern Wisconsin, it felt like that kind of woodsy landscape. So I had so much imagination and the ability to travel, to just walk on my own for hike in the woods for miles without really worrying about anything. And I remember picking mushrooms with my brothers and sisters and my father and mother, and blueberries and all these wild things we would gather from the woods that became part of our regular diet. And it was pretty easy to live that way and live pretty simple.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was reading a study. I mean, nowadays, kids go outside, they don't know how to play. They don't know how to use their imagination. They don't know how to use toys. I mean, they're so used to the computers and the screens that you give them, toys and you let them free outside, and they don't know where to start. They don't know what to do.
Yeah, it's funny. I even have some students that come to see me for meetings, and they'll be texting while we're having a meeting. So it's a little, it's quite a different world, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. Now, you also have a blog. You want to share with us about your blog and what you focus on? And I know you talk about sustainability and higher educational issues on that blog. But can you share with us your blog and what you do on it?
Sure. My blog is called On the Brink. It's a play on my name, but also we're on the brink of some significant issues coming up environmentally, right? And and you could find it by searching for my name and On the Brink, or it's bobbrinkman.blogspot.com. And I try to post about 5 to 6 times a week on environmental issues and issues related to higher education. Most of it's environmental issues. What I call it my informal writing. Years ago, I took a writing workshop with Julia Cameron, who wrote The Artist's Way. I don't know if you're familiar with her work, but her approach to writing, or for teaching writing, was to encourage people to have what she called morning pages, which are these pages that you write informally to clear your mind of things that might be on in your brain that might distract you from your more professional writing. And I started that, and then that turned into my blog. And so the blog has a lot of my informal thoughts about environment. So today, for example, I wrote about the China issue of China and this their move into cap and trade. But the day before, I wrote about some data that I was looking at about energy, renewable energy sources around the U.S. And Wisconsin is number one in energy produced by manure from cows, which makes sense since it's the dairy state, right? And so people will find interesting things that I run into related to the environment, things that I'm thinking about, research that I'm doing, updates on projects we're involved in at Hofstra. And because it's updated so quickly, so every day or so, I think a lot of people return to it regularly and find interesting information about a variety of environmental sustainability issues on the site. Mm-hmm. I also have a series that I've been doing on the national parks and And I also try to get some guest bloggers in on occasion. I've had some students who did amazing internships over the summer that will be posting their work up there in the next couple months as well.
Oh, that sounds great. You know, you mentioned Wisconsin as being a dairy state. I was so surprised, you know, in my research and circles, finding out that dairy production is almost as high as meat production in greenhouse gas emissions.
Yeah, it's terrible.
It's really terrible. And so, you know, you say they're using the manure for renewable energy. I'm curious about that and what can be done, you know, as someone who's coming from Wisconsin with all the manure that they're having there, are they using it for renewable energy, and is there a way to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions coming out of, you know, the dairy production on that scale? I try to buy organic and local so that I'm not participating. If I am going to eat dairy, I'm trying not to participate in that massive production of it. But can you share with us some thoughts on that?
Yeah, what they're doing is, and they're collecting manure from some of the larger dairy sites, and they're putting the manure in digestion tanks where they're actually pulling out the methane that normally would have gone into the atmosphere in greenhouse gases, and they're turning that into fuel for mini generators for electricity production. So it's a pretty nice system for those farms that have enough production that they can produce enough manure that would make it worthwhile. Of course, we always are trying to promote smaller agriculture, but we're not there yet. But in these big agricultural settings, it's a resource that we may as well capture and
Absolutely. Bring
to some good. Yeah.
And are there government programs to help those farmers do that so that we can keep, you know, for those listening that don't know, I mean, the manure normally, we're talking about CAFOs and feedlots, and, you know, this manure is just piled up in one place. So rather than a cow just going to the bathroom in the field and it going into the ground, that's all, you know, being washed down into waterways and getting, you know, polluting our water and, you know, is being dealt with as runoff, and it's really terrible. So,
yeah, exactly.
Is the government involved in any of those kind of renewable systems?
Absolutely. There are grants available to farmers to do this in many states. And what's interesting about it is that a lot of these initiatives started to try to actually reduce the runoff of manure into streams, because there are so many eutrophication problems. Eutrophication is just the over-nutrient content, or throwing tons of nutrients into streams so that they become oxygen deficient due to the production of algae, and it leads to fish kills. And Wisconsin had very serious problems with eutrophication in many of its streams over the last 30, 40 years because of agricultural runoff, especially from dairy areas. And
wasn't that what just happened in Toledo?
Exactly.
The green algae, or
exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
They couldn't drink
their
water for a few days.
It's terrible, right? And so, going back to my experience as a geologist, some of the places where I was trying to collect samples were from streams back in the mid 90s, where we would find many feet of manure in the bottom of streams just filling these small stream beds. So it was, agriculture has had a very, very heavy influence on the landscape of this country.
Oh, wow. Bob, so many questions I want to ask you, but let's take a couple-minute break. And when we come back, I want to really talk about the program you're running at Hofstra and share that information with everybody listening, okay?
Sure, be glad to.
Okay, everyone, you're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm speaking with my guest today, Dr. Robert Brinkman, the Director of Sustainability Studies at Hofstra University. Be right back. Hello, everyone, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Dr. Robert Brinkman. He's a professor and the director of sustainability studies at Hofstra University. Bob, you with me?
I sure am.
Great. So you're running the sustainability program at Hofstra, and prior to that you were at the University of South Florida. Can you share with us some of the differences? Environmentally and, you know, with the local geography and stuff, I'm sure there's differences. And also the students are different. Can you share with us some of the differences and where you see your program going?
Sure. At the University of South Florida was a big, giant public university, 50,000 students or so, whereas at Hofstra, we're a much smaller environment. We were able to work much closer with students to try to get them to achieve their goals and get them situated into good internships, into good jobs. We were able to do that at USF, too, but at Hofstra, we work a little bit closer with the students. The class sizes at Hofstra are capped at 35 at the undergraduate level. So students, and often they're much smaller. For example, in my capstone senior seminar this year, I have about 8 students that were working on a lot of really interesting things in the classroom because of that. So we're able to, I get a chance to work with the students on their projects and move them forward. For example, last year, I wrote a paper with a couple of my students on research we did on sports and soccer and sustainability and how the professional soccer is or isn't sustainable in their practices. So we do some interesting things with our students. A few of our students had amazing internships this last year. Two of them were actually at the Department of Energy working directly with some of the leading movers and shakers there. And one of our students was at the Sylvester Manor running their educational programs at the farm there on Shelter Island. Mm-hmm. And so we have some really great times with our students, and they get to do some pretty important things. And I approach sustainability education with the idea that we have a handful of decades to change the world before things get really bad. And I want to make sure that our students are out there trying to change the world for the better. So we try to give them real skills, real hands-on skills to get them out there doing good things. And that's what I'm most excited about, is getting them into the communities, into the field to do those types of intervention work, that type of intervention work.
Mm-hmm. You know, my question is, it seems like many universities that now are starting up sustainability majors if they didn't have them already. And with all of these graduates coming out with degrees in sustainability, what kind of jobs are there really, like have the companies that we need to become more sustainable, are they ready to do that transition and to do that work? And are they hiring our students?
They are, and I'm really excited about that too, because if you look at the green job movement, it's has had some slow expansion over the last 10 or 20 years in a number of different areas. But one of the most important areas is the area of entrepreneurialism. And so we get a lot of students who come to us and say, you know, I want to open my own company that is involved with hydroponic fish production, or I want to work in tourism and try to drive tourism in a more sustainable way. And that's exciting because these are people who are going to transform the world through economic development. So they'll be hiring people who will be working in green jobs and helping to transform our economy into a greener economy. But at the same time, there are a lot of major corporations. For example, I always have my students read Walmart's sustainability plan. A lot of people are shocked when they hear that Walmart has one, but they actually have a very strong sustainability initiative underway. So almost every company does. And while we might not necessarily think Walmart is the greenest company, it's important that we get good people involved with sustainability, helping to transform those companies into more sustainable organizations. You might have to you might feel like you're compromising yourself by doing that, but you're actually helping those companies move forward. If we look at a company like Unilever, for example, they've made a big transition into being having a very strong focus on sustainability that they didn't have in the past. So there's opportunities to help change companies around. And most major Fortune 500 companies now are evaluated on a number of ways, including sustainability indices, where their practices, how they spend their money, how they purchase things can be evaluated using these point-based quantitative systems. It's worth trying to teach our students some of those corporate sustainability approaches as well. So we're giving them a range of opportunities that allow them to be entrepreneurs, but also to get into the corporate world or to get into nonprofit volunteer work in a range of opportunities. You know, the sustainability field is so broad right now that the sky's the limit as far as employment.
Mm-hmm. That's one encouraging.
One of our students just got hired by a major consulting firm in Germany to work on energy issues. So, you know, things are going well in the field.
Great. Now, are you organizing students from Hofstra to attend the Climate March coming up on September 21st?
We are. We're so excited about that.
Good.
I know. We have a lot of students interested. We've got clubs out there getting the word out. What we're doing is we're trying to have a low carbon footprint ourselves. We're working with Sierra Club, which is providing a reduced fee for a reduced rate on the many of the trains in the area. So we'll all catch the Hempstead train at about 9:13, I think, is when the train goes out to Penn Station, and then we'll be part of the march with everyone else coming in to the city, starting at Columbus Circle. I think it starts at 11:30, and then we'll end up at I think it's 11th and 43rd. For the full march. We're really excited about it. Our students are jazzed about it because we've been working so hard on climate issues on our campus and trying to reduce our carbon footprint here that this is just part of the message that is important for Hofstra to get out, that we're part of this and we're part
right.
of this change.
Well, Hofstra really is. I mean, as you know, we met a few years ago when Hofstra hosted our Long Island Small Food Conference, which actually back then
That's
it was
right.
called the Long Island Small Food Farm Summit, but we've now changed the name to the Long Island Food Conference, and we're working together planning the next one, which I'm really excited about.
Yeah, April 25th.
Right, and Hofstra
is campus.
Hofstra is hosting us and really making it really available to us and making it affordable for us to have it there. You want to share a little bit about Hofstra's commitment to sustainability and some of the other things they're doing on campus that are in
Absolutely.
Alignment with this conference?
Absolutely. You know, Hofstra has a very long commitment to sustainability. We have a world-class arboretum on our campus. If you've ever been on our campus, it's really one of the most beautiful campuses you could be on, especially in the spring when all the bulbs are blooming. But we also are one of the few universities that has both a direct academic director of sustainability as well as a facilities director of sustainability whose job it is to try to reduce our footprint in a lot of different areas. So we actually buy carbon credits for 10% of our energy, which might sound like a small amount. We're actually one of the highest rated universities in doing that. There are only a handful that are above us. We also get about 25% of our electrical energy from our cogeneration plant on campus from the production of our electricity on campus. We've been moving to upgrade our lighting. We have room occupancy sensors in a lot of our buildings, and we're adding them on. We just added a new LEED certified silver building, our new medical school building, and we've made a commitment to build all of our new buildings to LEED standards. We're expanding recycling across campus. We just started a new recycling program on the south side of campus. We're hoping in the next couple of years to develop a new food recycling system or a composting system. We have student gardens on campus where students are in charge of gardening and growing their own food, and excess food is donated to local food banks.
Great. I didn't know that you had all that going on.
Yeah, there's so much going on, and we've put in drinking water refill stations all across campus, so students don't have to buy water bottles. They can refill. We think we've saved about 500,000 water bottles at this point just by putting those in. Mm-hmm. And our students participate in things like Recycle Mania and Campus Conservation Nationals competition to try to compete to recycle or reduce energy. And all of this has really gotten us a lot of attention nationally because we've been rated by Princeton in their Green Guide since 2011 as one of the greenest colleges, universities in the country. So we're trying every day to try to do more. Mm-hmm. And students are committed. The faculty are committed. We have really great support from our administration. So it's one of those things where everybody is on the same page on trying to do the right thing here.
That's excellent. How about the divesting of their investments? Have they been able to divest from fossil fuel companies yet? I know that's been a big push with 350.org and a lot of the universities.
Yeah, we've made some progress. You know, our students have been really active on this issue, as have our faculty. And we actually were one of the only universities in the country to meet with the board to talk about divestment. We made a presentation to them. We spoke to them about it. They are sympathetic to the issue, but at this time point, they're not ready to do it. But the door is open. We're going to continue educating them. We feel like we have a dialogue with our leadership and the board and our administration. So we're going to keep educating them, and hopefully one day we'll
be
turn
successful.
The corner on that. But I feel like, you know, we're far ahead of other universities where there's not an open door.
Right.
Where the conversation is not welcome.
And we're almost out of time, but just really quickly, I know you're coming out with a new book, and you've written a bunch of books. Your most recent one was on Florida sinkholes. What are you working on now?
Well, I just finished the first draft of a new textbook on sustainability. There, one of the things, if you teach sustainability at college campuses, there are a few textbooks to pick from. And so I decided to write one. It'll be published if everything goes well, with John Wiley and Sons, one of the major textbook publishers in the world. And the exciting thing about this is that I'll have the opportunity to help define the field of sustainability a little bit more so that we have a better sense of what it is and what it isn't, and hopefully find a way to get this information to more people as well.
Oh, that's great. That's great. I feel really good to know that you're behind a textbook on sustainability. I know you'll include all the important things, so that's great.
Yeah, we're trying. We try very hard to get this information out.
Thank you. Well, everyone, I want to thank you all for joining us. Bob, thank you so much for joining us. Again, you want to just share with people the address for your blog post if they want to read up on that, because your blog is really great, and I'd like to share that with everyone.
Sure. My blog is bobbrinkman.blogspot.com.
And Brinkman has two N's, just so you know.
Right.
Brinkman with two N's. Thank you, Bob. And everybody out there, thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'll see you all again next week. Have a great rest of the week. Bye for now. Bye.